So you have a new family that moves in next door. And on the same day, this family buys a brand new car. Now, you just happened to be reading earlier that day that this particular model scored the highest in its class in every single safety measure across the board. And you also happen to know that this car costs significantly more because of that high safety rating.
I'm giving them the evil eyes. What I'm
there you go. Now, from this, you reasonably infer that your new neighbors probably care a great deal about the safety of their family. But then, of course, you move in closer and you realize that the child's safety seat is attached with duct tape. So, you know, you can have this general fact about this family having paid extra money for this this very high-scoring safe car being evidence for the hypothesis that this family cares a great deal about each other. While at the same time, you can have more specific facts, mainly the duct-taped car seat, being evidence against that hypothesis. Now, if, say, somebody was in a position to know both of these facts, but yet they presented an evidential argument that appealed only to the general fact, mainly the fact about the car and the high safety rating and the increased cost of that car, if they appealed only to those facts in arguing that the family clearly cares about safety, then they would have an argument that seems like a strong argument, but they would be guilty of what Paul Draper calls the fallacy of understating the evidence.
In this original scenario, what should we weigh more heavily, the general fact or the specific
fact? The general fact should be weighed more heavily.
Why?
Well, because the specific fact takes as part of its background knowledge the general fact.
Okay.
Here's what Paul Draper says. He says, the fallacy of understating the evidence, he goes, quote, by this I mean that they successfully identify some general fact about some topic that is more surprising on naturalism than on theism, but then all too conveniently ignore other more specific facts about that topic that, given the general fact, are more significantly surprising on theism than on naturalism.
Yeah, so we could discover a variety of specific
there's
facts
a whole
about
bunch
this family.
Of them.
And at some point, when you start realizing, you know, there's lead paint around, they haven't cleared out the asbestos, kids are playing with plastic bags over their heads, and that's fun time for them. Eventually, your specific facts will
overpower your general
fact. Overpower your general fact.
In psychology, there's theories of licensing, though, where if you buy a nice, safe vehicle, you might feel licensed to have an unsafe car safety seat, so the two things could be linked. That is, if you feel that you did so much work and you're strong on one aspect.
Don't bring your science into my philosophy.
Don't have any empirical grounding with reality. We're talking.
I think, though, that works.
Maybe somebody thinks their argument is so good in generals that they omit the specifics.
Yeah, well,
that's true.
And that's one reason why we wouldn't let just one specific fact override the general fact either, because of those types of situations that you just brought up. We are weird human beings, and nature's somewhat anomalous, too. And
it all comes in degrees. Yeah. There's not one completely.
But if you get enough specific facts to mount against that, we might say it's the other way around. They bought the car because they felt so bad about the lack of safety in every other area.
Mm-hmm. Right. So again, Paul Draper is arguing that this tendency to understate the evidence is a pretty core feature to a lot of theistic arguments. So many will argue that the general fact that conscious creatures exist is very unlikely on the assumption that naturalism is true, right? Antecedently, right? So if you kind of abstract away all of our observations and you just think about a causally closed system, would we expect, given the processes that we know about, would we expect intelligent agents?
Yeah,
we wouldn't really.
It's pretty rare.
It's pretty darn surprising. But on theism, it would seem that such a thing is pretty predicted under that, right? Where you have a moral agent who wants to create other moral agents to be in a relationship with. So on theism, the existence of intelligent life isn't at all surprising.
Checkmate, atheist.
The issue, of course, is the question, does it ignore more specific facts that seem to undermine that evidential inference? And the answer to that is of course, yes. Specific facts, like, for example, that personalities and a sense of self are highly dependent upon physical brains, which, given the general fact, are very unlikely on theism. Another example of this kind of strategy Many will argue that religious experiences are less likely on the assumption that naturalism is true and more likely on the assumption that theism is true. But again, this would ignore specific facts about the topic. People who have religious experiences usually have pre-existing religious beliefs.
Their visions match
their cultural context.
Exactly.
It provides a schema to interpret any subsequent experiences.
So all these specific facts
they severely undermine the
look very different.
So on these kinds of issues, once you take on board you take on board the general fact that is being originally proposed in the argument, but then you also bring on board the specific facts that are countervailing. It's not at all clear at the end of the day, once you take into consideration all the evidence relevant to that topic, that it significantly counts as evidence for theism. I don't know that I would necessarily want to argue that it would count against theism, but it's clearly undermining any kind of interesting argument there. Contrast these arguments with, say, some of the more powerful arguments for atheism. So the divine hiddenness argument, you have the general observation that there are reasonable non-believers, right? But then you take on more specific facts, like that these beliefs are geographically distributed in a way that is unexpected or surprising on theism. On some of these more powerful atheistic arguments, you have both the general and specific facts aimed in the same way. Same with problem of evil, right? You can have, these kinds of suffering that seem like there's no real good at justifying reason. But then you also have facts about how pain and pleasure are intricately involved with one's ability to, reproduce and, all this kind of stuff. They're biologically intricate involved in that, which is another argument of Paul Draper's that we should get into one day. And there's actually a whole list of these things. And Jeff Lauder of the Secular Outpost has categorized the entire list, it seems, of the kinds of things that Paul Draper seems to be suggesting are guilty.
I see a philosophically heavy interview episode in our future. That might be fun to go over all these situations where it looks like it's pro-theism. But as soon as you scratch that surface.
Yeah. So in dealing with theistic arguments, it's always important to accept their general premise. If it's true, if it's the case that that the observation they want to focus in on is evidence for theism over naturalism, then allow that. But also say that that's not the end of the story. There's other more specific facts that if we take that into consideration, it might be the case that their argument is completely uninteresting because it doesn't really appear to point one way or the other at the end of the day. Now to the fine-tuning argument. That the cosmological constants of our universe are within an extremely narrow life-permitting range is a kind of central premise behind one of the more popular contemporary design arguments, the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God. Now, I don't actually have the scientific expertise to examine whether or not they really are within a narrow range, and there's also other concerns about whether it's even coherent to talk about a narrow range when the upper limit is infinite. But that's a whole other issue.
What constitutes narrow on an infinite scale?
So we can say that, if the scientific facts that they're appealing to are actually true, then that would count as evidence for theism, it would seem, and against naturalism, because it'd be very surprising on naturalism. But, of course, there are more specific facts, again, that seem to be strongly countervailing. So first, given that intelligent life of some sort exists, the fact that the vast majority of the universe is hostile to life is much more probable on naturalism than on theism. And of course, it's also the fact that the universe isn't filled with intelligent life. These are things that, given the kind of natural way that God has apparently chosen to create the universe by, turning these knobs in a special way, it seems awfully obscure that God is limited by knobs. He should be able to have a universe that is proportional to its central goal. Secondly, given that intelligent life of some sort exists, the fact that the vast majority of life came about through the process of biological evolution is much more probable on naturalism than on theism. The reason why this is because on theism, there are many more ways to bring about intelligent agents than there are on naturalism. On naturalism, pretty much, some kind of evolutionary process is really the only way you're going to come up with the variety that we have. But if that's the case, then the fact that it did come about through biological evolution, the variety of life, that seems to be an incredible coincidence that if God created the variety of life that we see, he just happened to pick the one option available on naturalism. It's an incredible coincidence, one might argue. Thirdly, this is one that I've kind of been developing myself, is given the general fact that intelligent life of some sort exists, the fact that it exists as physical, biological agents requiring fine-tuning is much more probable on naturalism than on theism. So if the parameters of our universe are within an extremely narrow life-permitting range, the fact that we exist as physical creatures might actually be countervailing evidence to the fine-tuning argument. So, of course, if theism is true, then there would exist an omniscient, omnipotent, and morally perfect non-physical person responsible for creating the universe. But, of course, given the moral nature of the being that theism posits, there exists a strong antecedent reason or expectation that she would create additional intelligent agency. So these would be contingent, morally free persons, you know, such that they might enter into a meaningful conscious relationship with God. But to say that theism contains within itself an expectation of additional intelligent agency doesn't really say much. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tell us what kind of agency. On theism, the number of possible ways that intelligent agency could exist is just painfully large. If God exists, she surely could create physical, biological, intelligent agency. But this is not suggested by theism itself. After all, God could have created physical, non-biological, intelligent agency. For example, imbuing a pile of stones with agency, right? So if anyone saw the Noah movie, you have these angels being kind of inserted, this pile of rocks being inserted with angelic agency.
Yeah, why not?
Where these rocks are walking around, you know, and they're acting, they're moral agents. They can interact and have to react in morally
interesting. That was in The Hobbit, too. The mountain rocks.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like Bishop Barclay's scenario, where it's all just a mental world anyways.
Yep. So, yeah, the three options, I think, three broad categories, rather, are physical biological agency, which we have ourselves or, you know, other great apes. Then you have physical, non-biological intelligent agency. So you could have, again, supernaturally animated rock people or a pair of anthropomorphic garden shears. You could literally have anything. And then, of course, the third category would be non-physical intelligent agency. Right? There's no reasons why we should expect there to be a physical realm at all. In fact, antecedently, because God is immaterial, we have more antecedent reason for thinking that God, that there would be an antecedent preference for non-physical agents. So it would be more intrinsically probable for that reason. Now, if I'm right about this, then on theism, it's at least pretty surprising that we should have physical bodies at all. Given the fact that physically embodied minds do indeed exist, how likely is it that we should observe such precise life-permitting nomological conditions, right, under theism? Well, the omnipotence of God ensures that she's able to create and sustain embodied minds in any environment. So even if it were the case that there was a physical universe that was completely not finely tuned, it doesn't matter, because God, through perpetual miracles, could create and sustain morally relevant agents in such a universe. So actually,
they're going to use some sort of simplicity argument, you know, hoping that Occam's razor cuts both ways. Like, wouldn't it just be easier to make embodied consciousness? Well,
I would say that it does cut both ways, because then you're brought back to just having immaterial. You know, you don't need physical. If they want to take Occam seriously, then they should stick with the immaterial realm and find just physicalness at all. Fairly surprising. You know, again, the constants being within a narrow range, that's only naturally discriminatory.
Right.
This is not something that God's hands are not tied in this way. And so it follows from her omnipotence that she could, you know, do anything with perpetual miracles. So if theists are correct in that biological life cannot exist without either fine-tuning or supernatural intervention, then that's fine. But, of course, if naturalism is true, then supernatural intervention is ruled out by definition. And so on naturalism, given the fact that physical embodied intelligent agents of some sort do exist, the probability that we would find that we would also observe fine-tuning is actually pretty darn surprising. on theism. And so we have, as part of our background knowledge, the fact that biological life exists, the observations recently made of supposed fine-tuning actually favor naturalism over theism. And so this is, again, a specific fact. Given the general fact that, you know, that fine-tuning would seem to, you know, confirm theism over naturalism, you have the more specific fact that the kind of agents that we are actually point the other way.
So the fine-tuning argument against belief in God.
Fine-tuning argument for naturalism.
What you're embarking on. I can certainly look at my own trajectory. It seemed to me that all the obvious clues that God must exist, whenever you studied more into the subject, it was just daunting to start to realize a God isn't necessary for explaining any of this.
Yeah. And in fact, I think that's largely the pattern of the show, is that you know, you can look at the very intuitive facts, but then when you actually get down deep into the details, it's quite a different picture.
Bottom line, don't get down into details and think about it.
Not if you want to remain a happy theist.